Good morning. Happy Saturday morning. This is the Todd Vino Show. I'm not Todd Vino. I'm Matt Brand. I'm simply filling in. Todd was doing Rick's show this week. I'm doing Todd's show this week. This is why I'm here. This is the only reason they ever call me in, because I'm the backup. But happy to be here. A nice Saturday morning. I think it's going to get beautiful out there today. Thank you to Todd for letting me take the steering wheel of his show. You know, if I think it was actually up to Todd, he probably wouldn't choose me at all. But nevertheless, I'm here filling in for Todd. Often I start this Saturday show when I fill in wishing everybody a happy Catterday. Well, today's no different. Actually, it's slightly different. I mean, it's finally here. It's a celebration. It's International Cat Day. Happy International Cat Day, everybody. I know I've been waiting for it. It's the ultimate Catterday, really. Every Saturday is Catterday, but today's super special. International Cat Day. I've been waiting for this personally. I've had it circled on my calendar. You know, these days pop up, right? Like, we see them all the time. International Cat Day, Pi Day, Car Day. There's a day for everything. Did anyone know that today was International Cat Day? We just wake up, right? We just wake up. For me, I the first thing I do, obviously, is just go right to Twitter. Just, why wake up like a normal person anymore? Just give into that technology. Roll over, check Twitter immediately, see what day it is. Today is International Cat Day. Did anyone do anything to prepare for this today? Sam Callio, producer of the Todd Vino Show, and producer of all the shows during this pandemic. I always take this chance to apologize to Sam. I'm sorry that you have to do all this extra work while I'm at home, while my kids beat me over the head with tennis rackets. Sam, do you have a cat?
I do. Her name's Gemma.
And Gemma, if you're listening, happy International Catterday. This is your special day. I'm sure Mama's going to get you something beautiful when you get home. Like, do you plan? You didn't get anything for Gemma, did you, Sam?
No.
And she's not going to notice if you didn't.
No, she sat beside me today when I drank my coffee. So we had a moment.
You had a nice Catterday morning, a nice international. That's if I'm I don't celebrate International Cat Day myself, but that sounds like the start of a traditional International Cat Day. Thank you, Sam. Okay, so coming up on today's show, I think I should mention some stuff, I guess. You know, top of the news, the Maple Leafs. I'm not really a hockey guy, but I did actually switch over from the Raptors game to the Leafs game. We won't mention what happened with the Raptors game, but the Leafs game, my word, three goals in the last 2 minutes of the game or something, and then they won in overtime. Spoiler alert, if you DVR'd it, usually the spoiler alert comes on the front end, not after I've spoiled the thing. So congratulations, Leafs fans. You know, what's funny about it, I'm not a big hockey fan. Call me later if you want to yell at me about this. We're having open phones from 11 till 12 today. But, you know, everyone is so happy. Anyone who's a Leafs fan is just so happy. But, I mean, you were like seconds from being really angry. You know, it's very fickle being a Leafs fan. You know, it could go either way. You're happy today, but you could have just as easily woke up this morning and heard me talking about International Cat Day and just thrown the radio because you're not in a good mood. But you're in a good mood because your team won. Just saying, hockey's just a bunch of bounces. That's really what I'm trying to say. Coming up on today's show, as I mentioned, from 11 till 12, we're doing open phones. This is my idea for the open phone in. Sam, of course people can call in about whatever they like. We just want people to call at the end of the day. You don't want me doing this by myself for an hour. It would be like what I'm doing right now, but for an hour. Nobody wants that. Trust me. And so, of course, big news on Friday, huge news. George's Island is open, but also Premier Steve McNeil stepped down. So I think for the call-in hour, what we should do, I want people to tell me, I want to know who people think should be the next premier. Now, if you want to call in and give a good answer, like that's what we want, you know, call in and this is who I think it could be. But just feel free to call in with literally anybody who you think. Your ma. If you think your ma is a good premier, call in and let me know. Tell me why your ma should be premier. Serious answers, great. Any answer, also great. Skeletor. So if I have to do it alone for an hour, I'm going to say things like Skeletor should be premier. This is why you have to call in. This is why you have to call in and help me. Because no one wants to hear that for an hour. That's at 11 to 12. Coming up on the show, actual guests. We're going to be talking about the Portapique inquiry and why that needs a feminist analysis, according to my guests. We're going to talk about a petition about Dal Nursing, racial injustice. Some nursing students feel like there's just simply not enough black students in the nursing program there. So we'll talk to them. Migrant workers. We've heard this week about issues with migrant workers and not getting the pay they need and maybe just some of the conditions they're living in here in Nova Scotia. We're going to touch on that. We're going to talk to Dr. Robert Hewish about what happened in Beirut, the international response. Man, just, it's 4 hours of show. It's just a laundry list. Lots of good stuff coming up. Tim Houston, Gary Burrell. We'll talk about Steve McNeil and long-term care. Lots of other stuff. Some Dal doctors, various doctors talking about researching things. Okay. We should take a break. If you want to reach out to me, great. I'm on Twitter at @M_brand. You can check that out. I'll try to tweet throughout the show. I do try to do that. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with our first guest. Actually, this is kind of cool. A drone operator. I noticed the horrible fire this week on Barrington Street. I should mention there is a fundraiser for the families. I'll tweet that out at my Twitter address at @M_brand. One thing I noticed, it's tragic what happened. However, I did notice that there's a drone operator, and I just thought, how does that help them? Just kind of cool to talk about the drone operator. So we're going to talk to Chuck Bizanson with Halifax Fire coming up after this. Welcome back to the Todd Vino Show here on News 95.7. I'm Matt Brand. I'm filling in for Todd. I know it's early. It's Saturday morning. The last thing you want to hear me do is drone on and on. But I'm sorry. Me and my next guest will be droning on for the entire segment. That's because I'm joined by Chuck Bizanson, Assistant Chief with Halifax Fire. He's also a drone pilot and the manager of Halifax Fire's drone program. Chuck, good morning.
Good morning, Matt. How are you?
Not too bad. I've noticed the last few fires. Obviously, we cover fires here at the station, and seeing the drone up and about just kind of piqued my interest. When did Halifax Fire start using drones, Chuck?
Oh, we started our drone program approximately 5 years ago, and it's evolving quite nicely. We have about 6 drones in service right now, and we try to fly them whenever we don't want to put people's lives in danger and we need some information that is only available from the sky.
And so when did the decision, I know you said it was 5-6 years ago. So when did the decision get made, and where did the idea come from? Like who kind of stepped up and said, you know what, we need to be flying drones?
Well, it's very interesting. We have a very keen captain on shift. His name's George Carmel, who brought the idea to me 5 years ago around the kitchen table, and we talked about it and we explored it. We looked at all the options available, and we decided, you know, there's so many things we can do with drones that we sometimes do with people, that we oftentimes do with people and put them in danger. And we started to walk down the road of what are next steps. And we bought our first drone and realized it had potential, but it was limited to weather. And since then, we've evolved to an all-weather platform, thermal cameras, 160 times zoom cameras. I mean, the options are limitless. So thanks to Captain Karma for having the idea, and together we've walked to where it is today. We have 20 very talented drone pilots on board in the fire department right now.
20 pilots. I just assumed that you were like the only one. I figured you were just on call 24/7. That's a lot of drone pilots.
It is. And the reason we have so many is we started the program with our hazardous materials program. And if you can imagine, if you had a leaking train car, trying to get close enough to read the placarding on the side, you will oftentimes put people in danger. So our hazardous materials people quickly realized that, you know, if we could fly a drone in and look at the label and look at the situation, it would be much safer to do an assessment that way. So in order to have enough pilots to always have a pilot on shift, we trained five pilots per shift, and that's for vacations and people who, you know, get promoted and leave the program or are unavailable for one reason or another. So we always have usually two on shift every day. And myself and our communications officer, Stephen Nearing, is also on call as a drone pilot. So in order to have the depth department-wide, we have quite a few.
And how did you become involved? How did you become a drone operator? Did you have previous experience, or did you just, once the idea was there, you just went with it?
Well, absolutely not. So part of the federal licensing program is that we have to have a drone manager. And as the manager in charge of the program, I'm required to be a pilot. So it was like, well, I wasn't expecting to be a drone pilot, but I guess I'll have to learn. And so I guess that just became a natural evolution. In order for me to stay in the program and manage the program, I needed to be a pilot.
How long does it take to get good at being a pilot?
So our program, we go through, you know, the Federal Advanced Pilot Licensing Program for drones, which is quite an onerous test that you have to write and study for. It's based on the CARS manual for planes, and almost like becoming a Cessna pilot. The exam is all about weather systems and elevations and rules and regulations and all the different flight areas you can and can't fly in, the different airspace classes. So after our pilots are successful in writing a test and getting the necessary advanced pilot license, then we put them through a rigorous training program. And until they've flown 15 hours, which doesn't seem like a lot, but it is a lot considering a battery only lasts 20 minutes, then we test them through a federal flight review program, and then they're drone pilots. And then it doesn't stop there. There's so much learning, just learning to operate the cameras, the various platforms that the cameras and the payloads that they carry is difficult in itself. If you can imagine, photography is a trade all by itself, and our cameras are extremely sophisticated. We have thermal cameras. We have thermal that have optical overlay cameras, so we can actually see through the thermal to see the actual image. So the training never stops for them. They actually are required to do so much training every month to guarantee that they're proficient at using the aircraft.
Kind of like a helicopter pilot. You have to keep up your hours.
Exactly.
Joined by Chuck Bazanson, Assistant Chief with Halifax Fire. He's also a drone pilot and the manager of Halifax Fire's drone program. So, Chuck, when you guys get out on scene and you send the drone up, what are you looking for? How does it inform the work that you guys do?
Well, really interesting. You might have saw it on Barrington Street the other day, and that was a fire inside an attic space, and we were, you know, very interested to know, because we used our thermal camera, how far the fire may be advanced underneath the roof area. So by using the thermal cameras without putting someone on a roof that may or may not be compromised, we're able to see the heat signatures and direct our crews to those areas. So that's just one small use of the fire. So as soon as we decide that there's a need, we put them up. It's quite a bit involved even putting them up by getting permission from air traffic to launch, making sure there's no other aircraft in the area. Obviously, an unmanned drone is doesn't take priority over a manned aircraft. So lots of traffic up there that we have to watch for and be aware of. So
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you about that too, because when I was doing my journalism school, we learned a little bit about drones, and I know there's restricted airspace. You need to you know, basically apply if you want to fly somewhere. So how long, when you get on scene, does it take you to get a drone up in the air, with given all these different parameters we're talking about?
Usually one phone call. So most of our phone calls go to the Shearwater Tower because they own most of the airspace that we usually fly in. And if we're not talking to Shearwater, we'll talk to flight control in Moncton so that we're aware. Our newest drones we fly actually have aircraft locators in them. So we'll see an aircraft long before it even comes into our airspace. And we also stay on the air channel that the aircraft use. So we can even hear aircraft in the area. So if we happen to hear aircraft in the area, we can tell them we're in the sky. But generally, the air traffic controllers will post a note them when we launch our drones so that aircraft know we're flying and can expect to see us. The reason we stay so safe when we're doing is we stay below where any aircraft should ever be. So we never go above 400 feet above ground level, and we should never see an aircraft at that level, except for perhaps a helicopter coming in for a landing. So we're extremely safe. We do have a policy with our drone program that if by chance a manned aircraft comes into our airspace and it looks like it's imminent that they may come in contact or come close to the drone, we will put the drone on the ground regardless of where it is. So we basically will crash the drone just to keep the people in the aircraft safe.
So you've basically, you have the direct line. You have the good phone number to call to get that thing in the air. I suppose I can't have access to that phone number, for example.
I believe that they are public access. It's just a matter of negotiating with those folks about, when you do and when you don't call. I mean, Shearwater has been very great with us. We've met with them several times. We've met with Transport Canada in Moncton several times about getting drones in the air. They've actually come and had a look at our program and think it's a very favorable program that we follow all of the rules. We're actually currently working with Transport Canada to get what's called a Beyond Visual Line of Sight license, which is unheard of in Canada. It's you must have your drone within your line of sight at all times currently, and we're working to be able to fly beyond where we can see our drone and fly it basically by instrument. So we're still evolving and hoping to get there, and that would be very useful for us when it came to assisting ground search and rescue crews with searching for lost or missing people.
And you touched on a little bit, Chuck, but could you just kind of talk a little bit more about how the drone has changed your job and just some of the benefits of having it there?
Great benefit for us is safety. We have a couple of smaller drones. We can fly indoors as well. So when we're dealing with hazardous materials or unknown conditions, with our thermal cameras, we can actually pick out a leaking gas cylinder. So it just makes it so much safer for us to be able to do that. We don't have to put people in place, and we have so much more situational awareness when we're looking at targets. For example, forest fires, oftentimes, they'll come in, or brush fires will come in as, smoke in an area, and we're able to put the drone up and pinpoint exactly where the fire is. Where years ago, people would, put on their forestry backpacks and pack through the woods and try to locate the smoke. And, they could walk for miles, and we can put the drone up and see the fire and see the closest access point and put people in. So it's safer. We're quicker to respond to the needs. We're in there a lot sooner, and so we're able to put the fires out a lot quicker. So there's been many, many benefits. And as I often say, the drones, as of yet, we'll never put out any fire, but they certainly make it safer and easier for us to do so.
I'm just speaking with Chuck Bezanson. He is Assistant Chief with Halifax Fire. As I mentioned before, he's a drone pilot, and he's the manager of Halifax Fire's drone program. Chuck, one thing I was wondering, you see the flames, you see the drone. How do you know how close you can fly it before you're dealing with plastic goo?
Well, that's a really good question. So part of the training is that when we're flying in and around the fire scene, it's not only the flames and the heat of possibly melting the drone. We're also worried about thermals, and thermals can carry the drone away and lift it and make it uncontrollable. So we tend to stay around the perimeter of any types of fires and not fly directly over any heat source. And our thermal cameras tell us exactly where we can and can't be. So it is about a learning curve. As you said, if you flew through those thermals in the intensity of some fires, you would have a plastic goo that you would find somewhere in the wreckage of the fire later on. So we're very careful not to do that.
Very good, Chuck. And just before you go, are you the best? Are you the best of all the drone flyers on Halifax Fire? You can tell me.
Absolutely not.
Chuck, there's your chance.
Absolutely not. We have some super talented people, and I try to keep my hand in when I can because I have so many other responsibilities, but absolutely not. We have some super talented pilots, so keen at what they do, and they're so good at using those aircraft that they make them dance in the sky.
All right. I gave you the chance, Chuck, but I appreciate you joining us this morning. I'm glad you're keeping your hand in it, but not anywhere close to the propellers. Chuck Bezanson, thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Have a great day.
Yeah, take care. That was Chuck Bezanson. He is with Halifax Fire, Assistant Chief, and he's with their drone program, which is pretty cool. As I mentioned, the theme today, International Cat Day, of course. Tracy Jessamine emails, can you do a special shout-out to the individuals who volunteer in cat rescue and people who save feral cats? Cat rescue people are about the hardest working people in rescue. Yes, Tracy, we can do that. Shout out to the people who volunteer to rescue cats and feral cats. It's you save a lot of cats that way, because I got a cat from a rescue, and I think probably a lot of people do too. So thank you for. And I'm breaking news from Sam, Sam Callio producer, Gemma, her cat, also feral, also a rescue. Thank you, Sam. So we're going to take a break. We're coming back right after this with, I'm going to work on these teases to see who's coming up next. Oh, yes, Jean Sarson and Linda McDonald. We're going to talk about a feminist analysis for the Portapique Inquiry. Welcome back to the Todd Vino Show on News 95.7. I'm Matt Brand, filling in for Todd. Joining me next, it took a little more than public pressure. Well, actually, it took quite a bit of public pressure, but the review into the shootings in Portapique was changed into a public inquiry. But there are still questions about what exactly the inquiry will look like. My next guests have a very definite idea of what the inquiry should include. Jean Sarson and Linda McDonald are with Persons Against Non-State Torture, and they join me now. Linda, how are you today?
I'm fine, Matt. How are you?
Not too bad. And Jean, thank you for joining us as well.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
So, we've heard a lot of people calling for a feminist lens on this inquiry or feminist analysis. But before we get into that, could you introduce yourselves and your organization?
Well, we're both feminist activists, human rights activists. We started a private nursing practice in 1993 and called it Flight into Freedom. And 6 months into our practice, we started listening to a woman who described being tortured. She lived in Nova Scotia, and her family tortured her here in Nova Scotia, tortured and trafficked her. So our work expanded to raise awareness about a non-state torture, which is torture by the everyday person. And we're now called Persons Against Non-State Torture. We're retired from Flight into Freedom, and we support and educate and are activists around the issue and forms of sexualized violence and femicide, which is involved in the mass shooting.
And you're both medical professionals as well. You're not just random people starting a cause. You're professionals.
Both nurses. You were retired nurses. Yes.
And so, again, this feminist analysis, a lot of people have been calling for it. What is that exactly? You know, it's something I feel like there's so much happening in the world right now. We're kind of bombarded with terms about all these different things, and keeping track of everything can be difficult sometimes. So when people say feminist analysis, what does that mean?
Well, a feminist analysis, Matt, really is a global awareness. It's as ancient as our species and as present as we are today, because globally, over time, the reality is that women and girls have never really been seen as equal to men and boys. And sometimes what happens, you know, we can think in Nova Scotia that women and girls are probably equal, but really there is the discrepancy in how women are paid for jobs that are equal to men. Those kind of discriminations exist everywhere on this planet. So when it comes to thinking about a feminist analysis, it's a word, but it really represents what has existed over time, the inequality of women and girls. And what we're asking in the inquiry is really to look at the whole issue of violence that women and girls suffer because of misogyny. Misogyny is here again an ancient reality. And to look at it in the broader context so that when people are saying we must do something so this never happens again, if we just focus on the violence that against the intimate partner and other women like Brenda Forbes, who was stalked by the shooter, intimidated and moved out of the community because of her fear. If we focus just there, that doesn't help men and women in this province and girls and boys think about relationships differently. So that's what a feminist analysis is looking at. Please, let's look at the relationships that cause violence in our community, that cause pain and suffering, and let's do something about the attitudes of misogyny that root violence. So that is what a feminist analysis is. But I think sometimes the word feminism intimidates people when it really shouldn't. It's the idea about human equality for all people.
And Matt, I'd like to say, too, that for people that don't know the word misogyny, because it is still a new word for many people, it means the hatred of women and girls just because we're women and girls, and it's an ancient way that came with us through the domination of patriarchy. And with the feminist analysis in the shooting, what we're asking for is that we expand our thinking beyond what the violence of the gunman exhibited and the misogyny of his behavior, and look at the misogyny of all the people around the incidents that could have prevented it, like the misogyny of the police in not listening to Brenda Forbes, and the misogyny is known to be in the RCMP. That's a known fact. The Deputy Commissioner, Kevin Brasseau, acknowledged that in 2019 in a public forum. He was talking about the misogyny in the RCMP. And then also the misogyny in the communities and in the province. So it's a much larger lens than just looking at the misogyny with the shooter or the gunman. And misogyny and causes femicide. It's connected to male violence against women, and it causes mass shootings, and they're all connected, male violence against women, femicide, which is the murder of women and girls because they're women and girls, and mass shootings. So we're asking for people to look at all those connections together, and we can get into prevention so that none of these atrocities can happen to women or men, because with misogyny, men can be affected as well. In femicide, men can be murdered in the homicides as well. So there is a connection with men and boys, too. We're not just caring about women and girls. We're caring about all of us in this province and in Canada.
I'm speaking to Jean Sarson and Linda McDonald. They're with Persons for Non-State Torture, and we're talking about a feminist lens put on the public inquiry and how that would work and how that might be able to do that. So you both wrote an article that went on the Nova Scotia Advocate, and in it you're holding up Mothers Against Drunk Driving as an example of real change and what can happen. Can you just kind of explain why you were kind of mentioning MAD in the article?
Well, I brought it up. This is Jean. I brought it up because, as I said in the article, my mother was killed by a drunk driver. And when she was killed, that really wasn't considered socially not such a bad thing. It was bad, but still it was normalized that drinking and driving, especially in relation to young men's behavior, was somehow accepted to some extent, even though it was criminalized as a violent crime. It was still had some degree of acceptance. So for me, when I was thinking of writing the op-ed, I was thinking about MAD and thinking about how it made a difference in Canada and different countries around the world. Like it started, MAD started in the United States with a mother whose 13-year-old was killed by a drunk driver. And it grew from there. And it just had the connection for me that violence, relational violence is the same thing. You know, growing up, it was always a family matter, and still sometimes today it still is a family matter. When we go back to the mass shooting and the fact that the shooter or the murderer was serially assaulting his partner, that members in the community knew about it. They knew he also strangled her. And still it was put aside because either people feared that if they said anything, the mass killer would also harm them. So it went silent. You know, that's what normalizing violence is. It means that we accept it, and often we go silent about it. So I brought that in because to show that we can do something different. We can change the attitudes in our communities, in our relationships, and across this country if we take it seriously. If we take misogyny seriously, if we take violent crimes seriously, that they should not be normalized, they are preventable. It's not that they're accidental. They are intentionally inflicted, so they are preventable. So, and I just want to add to that, the issue of misogyny, that's an ancient Greek word. You know, when we say it's an ancient crime or an ancient attitude, it's been with us for a long, long time. So the idea of MAD came because of the acceptance that intentional harms can be prevented. So that's why I brought in my personal experience also, because I wanted to share with people that I had some understanding of what it is like to suddenly lose a very intimate connection with a loved one to a very violent act that was preventable.
And I'm sorry to hear about your mother, Jean. And so I guess my question might be, if MAD can institute real change, for example, bringing in, you know, blood alcohol limits, that kind of thing, what could potentially come out of a similar thing from this inquiry? Like what real change or laws could, you know, tangible things that could make a difference?
Well, MAD went into prevention, and so a feminist analysis is for prevention as well. And one of the key prevention components that different people that we've talked to all across Canada, by the way, we've been contacted from women's organizations across Canada, lawyers, we've been contacted by many women since our articles have been written, disclosing more about the misogyny and how a feminist analysis helps them and understand the crimes that they've been enduring. But education is one key component, and we've all been talking about how important it is to educate our children, to educate about equality, and if they learn very young in grade 4 that boys and girls are equal, and what misogyny is, and what feminism is, and all the different forms of violence against male violence against women, including femicide, we'll break down those beliefs, because misogyny is a belief and a feeling that we can hopefully prevent much of the suffering that's going on. And one of the things I wanted to say is the other controversy that's coming up is that the gunman might have been a informant. We're not saying that he was or wasn't. He could very well have been. We don't have any knowledge about that ourselves. But those two realities can exist at the same time. He was definitely a misogynist, and he could have been an informant. So we're not disputing any other facts that might come about around his behavior or how this crime occurred. But we are saying that we want a feminist analysis included in his recognition in our social formation so that a whole picture can be seen. It's not we're wanting to take over the picture. We're just wanting one more wedge of reality in the picture.
And another thing Jean, you mentioned earlier about Mad, to go back to Mad for a second, that, you know, they... not just the real change they brought with you know, the blood alcohol levels, but where at that time when you were a kid and that horrible thing happened to you and your mom, you know, the kind of how people view drunk driving at the time and, you know, something young people did or young men did. And somehow at that time it was not okay, but not as frowned on as it is today. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, what do you think generally people think about domestic violence, intimate partner violence today, and that needs to change?
Well, in some ways, I don't know if it's changed a whole lot first. Also in that article, I also wrote that Linda and I both grew up in family violence. In different articles, we both disclose our past because our past influences how we respond to a situation today. And of course, Mad, my experience around Mad influences how I decided to respond to some extent to the mass shooting and the violence that went there. So, going back to your question, when I said that both Linda and I grew up in family violence, with Linda, the family violence was quiet. It didn't matter what she said. People just didn't believe. So that's one aspect. And I think that also showed up in the mass shooting when Brenda Forbes explained to Nova Scotians and Canadians who were listening to her that when she tried to explain to people that the shooter was really a dangerous man, it's like, no, he really wasn't. This is what she explained, like it really wasn't believed. For me, I grew up, my father was very violent, but it was very community aware because he was not silent. He was not behind closed doors. I mean, he was raging out in public, but still it was considered a family matter. So in some ways that both of these realities, not believing or it was a relational matter, existed still in the mass shooting. So I think that we really have to get serious about knowing that we can change these attitudes, and the only way it's going to change if we talk about the violence just like we talk about the weather. You know, people feel, well, if I say something or if it happened to me, there's something wrong with me or it's something I should be ashamed of. And it's not. It's nothing to be ashamed of if a person is suffering a crime. If you're being victimized, it is a crime. So it should not be secretive. So for me, that's where Mad went. It said that drinking and driving is not okay. And we have to stop the attitudes that present it as being okay or tolerable or in some way normal. So for the mass shooting and for the violence that went on, if we don't look at a feminist analysis and say we have to make it a larger social issue, that communities and individuals, we have to know how we're going to change our attitudes and how we're going to respond, how we have to even change laws, change our behavior so that this does not happen again. This is not an accident. This is preventable. So we have to do that. And we won't do it if we focus solely on the perpetrator and his violence. That's only one individual. That makes it easy to say, well, that just belonged in this situation, which is incorrect, totally incorrect. We know across this country and across the globe that 33% of the women and girls on this planet will, over the age of 15, will experience sexualized violence or physical violence in their lifetime. And that's just one form of relational violence. So we really need to take this opportunity, and I think we have to welcome this opportunity to be able to say we can do something different here. We can make a difference.
I'm speaking
and if I can give one anecdote, in talking with different women around the mass shooting that have come to us, one woman disclosed who worked for a police department in this province, I won't say where, but she acknowledged that the police had described domestic violence or male violence against women as a lesser crime. And that term rings out in my ears because it says then the violence that women and often children, because they're in the family and endure it along with the mother witnessing or experiencing it directly themselves, that we are lesser people. Because really, domestic violence or male violence against women is a very serious crime, and we can see now a clear example of why that is, because it spills over from the home onto the streets, into our neighborhoods and communities, and we all suffer from it economically, emotionally, relationally, and the legacy of this crime is lifelong for all of us in Nova Scotia, and it will be for many generations to come. So it's never would never be a lesser crime. It must always be considered a serious crime. So if that's the conversation in the police stations in our province or across this country, because, you know, when I was a child, my mother being beaten by my father was not even considered a crime. So we have evolved from that into the 80s. But we're now talking about it as a lesser crime. That's not good enough. It has to be a serious crime. And we as communities and neighbors have to understand it as a very serious crime, too, so that we can prevent the femicide and the homicide and the mass shooting that and the male violence against women as well. So, you know, it's a, like Jean said, it's an opportunity. It's a gift for us to move forward and become a better society for us all. And that's simply what we're pushing for.
How does this get included, this feminist analysis? How, I mean, we're talking about including it. How do you go about getting it included?
Well, I put out an all-points bulletin on Facebook asking people to call Bill Blair, to write Bill Blair, and we can call Minister Fury and write Minister Fury. Talk to your local MPs, MLAs. Push in whatever way citizens can in this province that agree with us or other people across Canada, because it has been the families pushing for sure. Jean and I have pushed for an inquiry. We came out on April the 25th with a press release along with Feminists Fighting Femicide, pushing for an inquiry. That was part of our push. Now the second part of the push is the feminist analysis. So we're asking for people to do whatever they can to use their voice and to keep pushing, because I do believe we still have hope that the possibility that, because they have domestic violence in the framework and the review, and they're saying they're going to carry that forward. Well, what we're saying is that's not broad enough. We want to see the words feminist analysis right in the mandate of the inquiry, and that will open the door for all the conversation that we've had here today with you, Matt.
Yeah, and I would add to that, Matt, it would really be essential for me that Minister of the Status of Women in Nova Scotia, Kelly Regan, and also the Minister of the Status of Women federally, Ms. Monsef, that they come on board. Their mandates are the issue to eliminate gendered violence and to promote human rights equality of women and girls. And they're really silent. So to make this happen, they could add their voices to that request. When I looked at the review, we had, it was solely in the domain of justice and public safety. And it seemed to me that if collectively, if we are to function together as a society, that these two ministers should have also been included in the discussion, and they should have a voice here. So I would challenge that the ministers come on board and also promote the equality, because it will benefit everyone. It's just not about women and girls inequality. It's also about what inequality does to relationships with men and boys and our society. So when you ask that question about how to get it there, I would also, if any of the ministers are listening, I would ask the ministers to give voice of support.
Okay, thank you, Jean. We're just out of time. Jean Sarson, Linda McDonald, Persons Against Non-State Torture. Thank you for your time this morning, and I hope this goes well.
Thank you very much, Matt, for your time.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Okay, that last segment was super long, so this segment will be super short. Just a reminder to give us a call at from 11 to 12. Who should be the premier? It could be anyone. It could be someone who's reasonable, or you could just tell us why your ma should be the premier. That's from 11 to 12. We're going to take a break with Steve Gow and the news after the commercial.